We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And good morning. I'm WILL TV Program Director David Teal, and I'm your guest host for this hour of Focus 580. Well, it's the third Monday of the month, and we take your home improvement questions. Joining us in the studio this morning is Scott Spees of Spees Home Inspection in Champaign, Illinois. The number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area is, of course, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the area, anywhere in the U.S., you can use our toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And you can also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Good morning, Mr. Spees.
Good morning, David. Thanks for having me on today.
Yeah, so we're coming up, pretty much the end of summer, beginning of fall. What should we be considering now?
I was on the way in this morning and noticing that some of the yards are starting to look a little peaked. So it reminds me that, the plants are starting to go into remission. Mm-hmm. Probably this would be a good time to take a walk around the exterior of the home. Things like trees and brush that are close to the siding or close to the roofs. As soon as we get into the snow and ice area, which unfortunately is coming on us faster than what everybody mm-hmm. really is expecting yet, we don't want the branches and the bushes up against the siding and up against the shingles. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend a good time to go around the outside and do a tree trimming / brush trimming and just get the vegetation out and away so that we don't have any problems over the winter with the when we do get our winter storms. Also, this is a time of year that our squirrels and raccoons and possums in this area are looking for places to nest for the winter. So if you have a lot of tree branches overhanging a roof or items that are close to the house that they can climb up on, they can tend to want to get onto your roof and then find access in your home looking for holes in soffits or around chimneys or a roof fence and things like that. So, as I'm coming in this morning, I'm thinking, it's just about time to go up there for my fall gutter cleaning and take the loppers up on the roof and start knocking some branches down so that I don't have to worry about them over the winter.
Great, great. Well, we, of course, already have calls. This is terrific. We have, let's go first to Lafayette, Indiana on line 4. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your view on window wells for the basement windows? Are they necessary?
A window well is usually in place around a window which is below the grade to allow the soil to be built up next to the window without actually coming in contact with the wood frame or the glass itself. And depending on how low the window is in the below the grade, how deep the basement is, et cetera, I recommend window wells on a regular basis. They can be raised up, and that will allow dirt to be put up against the window well, whether they're made of masonry or whether they're made of metal, something that just extends out from the house, but is higher than what the bottom of the windowsill is, so that you can change the grade and maintain a slope around the house that directs water away from the house.
All we need is a good means of protecting those light plastic covers from falling icicles.
Well, the covers themselves are not necessarily as necessary as the window wells. The window wells, of course, are to help direct water away. The covers... a covered window well will reduce the amount of leaves and debris that will blow in there in the fall, things like that. But really, it doesn't do much as far as keeping water out. If you've got a good slope away from the house, the cover itself is more to keep the wind from blowing debris in there, more so than worrying about rain and such. But yes, the light plastic ones do tend to get a little bit of damage from the gutters that are overflowing and the icicles that are falling down. But really, the covers are not as important. Because
maybe I could remove them just for the winter.
Yeah, there's no real reason to have them on there. I've seen people that worry about how much water runs down in there. But, if you put a bowl out in the middle of the driveway and let it rain, it doesn't really fill the bowl up. Well, if that's all the water you're going to get in that window well, it's really not going to fill the window well enough to run in the window.
Okay.
Now, I have seen instances where the grading is not correct and the water does run back to the foundation, and the window well, it becomes a collection point, and we do get 3 or 4 inches of water standing in the window. Unfortunately, that's not the fault of the window well, and a cover is not going to correct that because that's the water drainage patterns of the yard more so than water that actually just literally fell into the window well.
Okay. A quick one here. Mine is an older house, has just two wires for its electrical wire. With just two wires, are surge protectors or GFCI any real protection?
Okay, a ground fault circuit interrupter, which has a little circuitry in there to measure the voltage relative to ground. If it notices that there's some power missing, it turns the power off before you can receive a fatal electric shock. You know, so your finger tingles and your hair stands on end and you wish you hadn't done whatever it was you just did. But they will work on ungrounded circuits. They will only protect themselves. If you put a ground fault circuit interrupter in a grounded outlet, it will protect everything else farther down the circuit. But if you have an older home and want to put them, right now the current codes would require a ground fault circuit interrupter for outdoor outlets, bathroom outlets, unfinished portions of basements, any outlet over a countertop in the kitchen, any outlet within 6 feet of a sink, basically places where you can mix water and electricity. And so in a bathroom with an ungrounded system, you would have to put one in each outlet. If we have a grounded system, we could probably find the one outlet that protects or one outlet that is first in the circuit. And generally the way the electricians wire it, most bathrooms are all on the same circuit. So you find the first one, put a GFI in that, and it will protect even the other bathrooms as well as the other outlets in that same bathroom.
I was thinking of protection against lightning storms.
Okay, that's surge suppression, and surge protectors do require a ground. When there is a sudden voltage spike, a surge protector does shunt the additional voltage to a ground supply. And if you've got a two-prong outlet, it is not grounded. Now, you can run an adapter. Most of the adapters have the little pigtail or a little tab on them. Nine times out of ten, when I see them, nobody has connected that to anything. Ideally, that little ground should be connected to a cold water pipe with a clamp, and that way the additional voltage will be shunted direct back to ground through the copper water lines. Of course, if we run the new PVC lines or the new poly lines, that's not going to work so well. But yeah, for surge protection, we definitely need to have a ground. But for a ground fault circuit interrupter, it will work without a ground.
Thank you, sir.
Well, thanks for the call. And we've got several other callers lined up here. Line one in Urbana. Good morning, Urbana.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a problem with mildew on the outside of the house.
Oh, I have that too.
Yeah. It seems to be worse this year because probably the wet spring. However, I think it may be because there's no vapor barrier on the wall, and I suspect this is the case. I haven't looked at it, but when we bought the house, there was no insulation at all in the sidewall and only 2 inches in the ceiling. It was built about in the mid-50s. Now, I don't know if I can describe it enough over the phone to
okay, well, the first question,
give me an idea.
Yeah, the first question would be, what kind of siding?
Well, it's wooden siding. And I guess you'd call it weatherboarding, about 6 or 8 inches wide,
okay.
Horizontal. And there is a black kind of a tar paper material, 4x8 sheets that's fastened to the studs before the outside was put on. And on the inside, there's just, I think it's 3/8 drywall, and then, of course, paint. I don't know if there's any simple way to put a vapor barrier on there.
Well, the tar paper is considered to be a vapor barrier. So we do have some protection to reduce the amount of moisture from inside the house. I would say part of your problem is that the paints available today do not have the chemical makeup of paints of old that used to reduce the mildew growth. Yes, we are banning lead-based paint, but I tell you what, lead-based paint never had any mildew growth on it. So you, when you repaint the house, what you'll want to do is make sure that you get a paint that has an algicide in it, something to reduce the plant growth. I'm going to say that you, most likely your problem is due to more of a either a poor quality paint or a paint that doesn't have the algicide in it, and so we're getting a little bit of dirt there. And yes, because of our really humid spring and summer that we had this year, we had plant growth, mildew growth, mold growth on just about anything and everything that did not see a lot of sunlight and stayed dried out well. So the backside of the house or areas that were heavily shaded, we do have this same problem.
Now, we did blow in fiberglass insulation with an adhesive to keep it from settling about 10 or 15 years ago, and we didn't really notice this formation of the mildew until this year. We had it painted about 3 years ago, and we used Sherwin-Williams paint with mildew-resistant part to it. In fact, the contractor came around and took a sample of it and took it over to the dealer, and they looked at it, and they said, well, it's the fault of the paint, the fault of something else. So they didn't take any care of it. And I'm going to have it pressure washed, and I don't know if there's much I can do in this time of year. I've asked the contractor if he would take a look at it, but that's been several weeks ago, and he's been so busy he can't get over. But I don't know if of course, you have a home inspection service. I wonder if we could call maybe off the air to your office and have you come over and look at it and see what you think of it.
Well, that's always a possibility. There's some things you could look for. Usually if we have a moisture problem on the siding that is from inside the house, what we do is we find the moisture problem inside the house. And most of the time that would be a vapor barrier missing from a crawl space, a power humidifier improperly set, something to actually become a moisture source inside the house. You said you're getting ready to pressure wash your siding. I would be very, very careful with that. Pressure washing siding, pressure washing works really well on things like concrete. Once you get up to siding, siding is a lot softer. I actually would prefer to see a good stiff bristle brush and a garden hose. It's about as much pressure as I like to see on siding. You can actually blow the paint, or I've seen them actually cut into the lumber if they get the spray nozzle too close. Usually you can put a mild bleach solution or an algicide solution with your water and basically wash the siding with a good stiff bristle brush. I have in the past recommended brushes that they would use for washing of large motor homes and such. They've got an extendable wand that you can connect to your garden hose and reach up 15, 18 feet. Without too much problem.
Would there be any damage to the shrubbery?
Well, depends on what chemical we're using with the water and how much of it you use. I would put a water bleach solution in a sprayer, like a garden sprayer, and kind of spray the house and let it dry. And then what will happen is the bleach will kill off most of your mold and mildew. And then after it has dried, then you go back with the brush and scrub off the remaining plant life that's no longer growing but still clinging to the siding. Mm-hmm. And that should prevent any damage to your growth around the house.
Oh, good.
But, yeah, the pressure washing, particularly siding, is really not all that watertight. It's waterproof, not watertight. So when you pressure wash, you can actually get water in behind the siding. So we try and avoid the high pressure blowing the water behind the siding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Scott.
Well, certainly. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, bye.
Thanks for your questions. And let's just go right on down the line to line two, calling from Champaign. Champaign?
Hi.
Hi.
We have a house that was built in 1948, and it had vertical cedar siding on it. And when we purchased it in 71, the owners then said it had been covered with a wide vinyl siding because they said they, quote, couldn't keep paint on the wood. Anyway, it's time to redo the siding, and we were wondering about both the payback and the cost of adding extra foam insulation on the outside. Now, in previous years, we have had additional insulation blown into the walls and laid down in the attic, bats of insulation. And we're trying to decide, does it make any sense to, go the extra expense of putting on this foam insulation, like 1 inch?
Well, that's a good question. If you've already got a full thick insulation in the wall cavity, generally a 2x4 cavity, so we can put in 3.5 inches of insulation, then your exterior insulation, while it does help, it's kind of a diminishing return, because the more insulation we get, then the less energy we're saving with the same amount of insulation. Trying not to make this too confusing. If you've got a 3.5 inch insulation bat, you have what we'll call an R11 insulating value. So, so 1/11th of the heat that gets to the wall will go through it. So the other 10 parts are effectively reflected back into the house. Okay, so if I've got one part out of 11 that's getting through, and then I put an R4 board on the outside of it, so I end up taking that one, the one part that got through, I managed to reflect three parts of that back, so only one part of it gets through. So I'm only saving 3/4 of the one part that was getting through. So the more insulation we start adding, the more of a diminishing return. It is a good idea to start closing the house up and getting it tighter and tighter. A good house wrap will probably do almost as well as a foam board, because probably my guess would be most of your heat loss now is not necessarily the heat going through the insulation, but air moving through the insulation. Since insulation doesn't actually insulate, all it does is actually hold air, and the air itself is our insulator, these little air pockets. Air is the best insulator out there. If we can hold a quantity of air and prevent it from moving, it will not transfer heat well. If we end up with some air moving through it, then it takes the heat or cold, whichever is in the air, and will transfer it through that insulation. So when we have a high differential in temperature, say the inside of the house is 80 and the outside of the house is 0, yes, we're going to get some movement through there, but if we put a house wrap and help reduce the amount of airflow through that, then that will actually increase the energy efficiency of the insulation that's already in place.
Okay. So what I want to make sure I understand this in plain English. When you were talking about you're getting 3/4, so it would be 3/4 of the 1/11th that's getting through. That's what we're going to save, basically.
Right, right.
It's not a lot.
Exactly. Right? That's why I say you end up with a diminishing return. The more insulation you have, the less you're actually saving. You know, you spend the more less of the money you spend is actually coming back in energy savings.
Okay, and the point of the house wrap is to reduce the actual movement of air.
Right, and so that the insulation that's in place is actually more efficient, because it's not the thermal convection is not moving air through the fiberglass insulation as easily with the house wrap on the outside. And the house wrap is breathable, so it will allow water vapor through, but not the airflow.
Okay.
That way we don't end up with moisture collecting inside the insulation or inside the walls.
Okay. Why did I think that the standards for insulating walls had raised, though, that we were actually supposed to have more? Or does it depend on how much actual space you have to fill up with insulation?
It's pretty much dependent on how thick the wall stud is. Uh-huh. They do, currently a 3.5-inch fiberglass bat is rated for an R11. A spray-in insulation, there are different numbers that we can throw out there. Cellulose or spray foam, you can get up to an R13 or maybe an R14 in that same space. And then you figure that there is a sheathing board on the outside, which adds some. Then there is a drywall on the inside, which will add some. So most builders are considering what I'll call an R11 wall or a 3.5-inch wall. Most builders are considering that between 17 and 19 because of the layer of paint, the drywall, the sheathing on the outside, the house wrap on the outside of that. So the wall in general is higher than what the insulating value of the insulation in just the stud space.
Okay. All right. Well, that helps a lot. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you. And just to let people know, if you tuned in late, I'm your guest host, David Teal, for this hour of Focus, and we're here with Scott Spees of Spees Home Inspection, taking your home improvement calls. And let's take another one in Urbana on line 3. Urbana.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have a question about indoor painting. My husband and I moved into our home about a year and a half ago, and we know that the previous owners painted the entire house before putting on the market, apparently in haste, because just this spring we noticed what we're pretty sure we determined to be an old watermark from an old leak that had come through the paint in one of the rooms. And so we were wondering what the best way to cover up this watermark would be so that we're not haunted with the same problem in another few years.
Okay, and actually that is a relatively common problem. Standard paints, generally latex that we would use, will bleed through paint stains even though there has not been any additional water or additional staining. They will telegraph or show through after time. So if you've got a stain, you need to put some type of sealant over the top of it. Usually the best is a stain killer. I believe the local brands that are easily found are Bins or Kills, and they're available in brush-on, roll-on, or spray cans in some cases. Effectively, they're a white shellac, and the white shellac that acts as a sealant to prevent any of the discoloration from bleeding through the new paint. Of course, the first thing we have to do is make sure that we are not getting more water that's creating the problem. So if you've got a spot where you think that, hey, we had a leak here, see if you can figure out what it was that they did to correct the leak or what was causing the leak, just to make sure that we're not painting over it and then find out, well, we do actually have more water coming through.
We did. We monitored it over the summer, and we didn't see any change in the leak, and we went up to the attic, which was right above the leak, which is directly under a joist. We peeled back the insulation, and we could see on the joist where there was an old water stain, but the joist and the insulation were both dry, and we kind of put a drip pan right above that point all summer, and we didn't find, and it was perfectly dry, so we're pretty confident that it's an old leak. We never did exactly determine what the source could be, though.
Well, roof leaks are definitely interesting to try and find because the water can come in and get underneath the shingle, and then, of course, the shingle is laid over the top of a sheathing board, so then the water can follow between the shingle and the sheathing board by capillary attraction and move, you know, 3 or 4 feet one direction or another before coming out at a seam in a board. So, yes, it can be, but it does sound like you have done pretty much what I would recommend, and that is the drip pan and check to make sure the insulation is dry in that area. So, yeah, at this point, I would say you're correct in that your assessment as far as needing to seal the stain before repainting. So,
okay, so it's called a stain killer then.
Yeah, a stain killer or stain sealant.
And then do we need to prime over that, or we can just do the
as a general rule, they are considered to be a primer, so that they are the actual primer that you would use.
All right, and so since it's just on one small section of the wall, there shouldn't be too much of a problem with blending into the rest of the wall then?
Well, matching the top coat is going to be the tricky part, but the stain killer underneath should change the top coat very little, so as long as you've got some of the old paint left, yes, you should be able to.
Well, we're lucky that they left us with some then.
And
thanks very much.
Now, do remember, when you put the new paint on, you're going to have to wait 3 or 4 days before the color will blend, because as the paint dries, it will change color.
Sure. All right. Well, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. And we've got a caller who's been waiting very patiently over on line four from Pontiac. Line four.
Hello.
Hi.
I have kind of an interesting electrical question. I recently got Wi-Fi in my house through the cable company. And they came in, and when they put it in, then when they tried to rehook the cable up, there was a spark from the cable that fried this little box that gave me some extra channels. It completely destroyed it. So I then had the electric company come and test the outlet, and it's a grounded outlet. And they did a couple little things and said, no, it's fine, it's fine. So the cable company came back. They replaced all the cable in my house, which was old. And they went to hook it up, and they tested it, and it still did this spark from the cable. So they did a couple things. They brought in another TV, and they brought in their own power source, and they plugged it in, and that worked fine. And eventually they went around the corner and plugged my TV and everything into a ungrounded plug, and it's fine. Now I'm waiting for the electric company to come back, because it has something to do with the grounding. And I just wondered if you had any clues that I can try and get the electric company to check, because I don't want to fry my TV out and have them hook it up. So, you know, Does this make sense in any way?
Yes, it does to a certain extent, and it is something that's going to take a little bit more work to try and figure out. Since you have an ungrounded outlet, I'm going to assume that the outlet the television is plugged into was grounded later and not necessarily grounded by a three-wire circuit all the way back to a service panel. So we need to figure out what they did to quote-unquote ground that. If they ran the ground wire to a water line, if they ran the ground wire, I've seen particularly in older houses, that any steel line that they find in the basement or crawl space, they hook it up to. And I would have to frown on the couple that I've found where they try and run a ground wire to the gas line. Grounding electrical to gas lines are never a good idea. So it may be that where the connection, you can plug a tester into your grounded outlet and it'll test as grounded, but how is that outlet being grounded to the actual ground or to the actual box, the electrical box?
What I need to ask the electric company is to check where that's grounded. That they did not do.
And it could be that it's grounded to a water pipe that doesn't have a good connection. It could be that we've got a ground going to something that is touching even the siding, since your cable is all connected to siding on the outside of the house. If you've got a metal siding, I've actually seen siding become a conductor.
I don't.
Okay, it's a wood siding.
Yes. But is it the ground that the cable's connected to or the ground that the outlet's connected to?
I'm not going to be able to answer that. It could be either or.
Guys should know.
They'll have to do some checking. It could be a loose ground back in the service panel. You could have – I've run across that. I had a house where every time the a fan started somewhere, all the house lights in the house dimmed, and it turned out that the ground cable at the service panel was loose. And so everything was grounding through other items rather than through that ground panel. So, yeah, they're just going to have to go through the house and see if they can figure out where their ground connection is faulty.
Okay. Thanks very much.
And thank you for your call. And we've got, let me give the phone numbers real quick here. 333-9455 is the number to call in the Champaign-Urbana area. And, of course, you can use our toll-free line at 800-222-9455 and will-talk at illinois.edu if you want to send an email. We're talking with Scott Spees of Spees Home Inspection, taking your home improvement calls. And we've got a caller from Champaign on line one. Champaign, good morning.
I have another insulation-related question for you. I have an extension on the back end of my house that has a tile floor, and I believe that they tiled directly on top of the foundation because of, the angle of where the floor is indoors compared to outdoors, and it gets really cold in the winter. So what I'd like to do is cover it with, maybe some sort of insulation and then tile over that. But I wasn't sure what would be the best choice of insulation, if I could do some sort of styrofoam board and then put like a ceramic tile on top of that, or is that just generally a really bad idea?
Okay, I'm going to make a rash assumption that we're talking about a concrete slab that somebody's enclosed and added onto the house.
The original part of the house has a basement, but this is an extension on the back, and mm-hmm. I think one part of this room is the back porch, and then when you go down a step, it's just, the same level as the outdoors. So I'm pretty sure it's concrete that's covered over in some sort of like broken-up brickwork tile.
Yeah. Okay, well, you're going to have a harder time insulating the tile, the ceramic tile, when you put it over the top of a concrete slab.
Yeah.
Particularly since a concrete slab that was built as a patio does not have what we'll call edge insulation.
Mm-hmm.
Masonry products, concrete, ceramic tile, things like that, do transfer heat relatively well. When we build a home with a concrete slab, around the exterior of the slab, between the slab and the foundation footings and the outside walls, we actually put a bond breaker insulation so that any cold surfaces from outdoors doesn't transfer into the first few feet of the concrete slab. And I'm afraid what's happened on your addition is that somebody has not done that. They just took an existing slab and built over the top of it, so we don't have any of that edge insulation. So it wants to take the heat from inside the room and wick it towards the outside walls, which, of course, means that particularly the first few feet around the outside walls are going to be colder than the center. But your ceramic tile is going to feel colder also. You can put a a backer underneath there. Actually, they do for that particular purpose. You may want to consider one of these radiant floor heating systems where they actually put a mat down that has a heating system and you put your ceramic tile over the top of it and then you control that.
That was my second question, actually.
Yeah. For that type of a situation, if you're insistent on using the ceramic tile for the flooring, then yes, one of those floor warming systems would probably be your best bet for making that comfortable. And it would also help increase the comfort level of the rest of that room because your body acts as a radiant heater. And if you're standing next to any cool or cold surface, you tend to radiate heat towards it. So a floor that is radiating heat up means that you feel much warmer in the room. And since we're on a concrete slab, my guess is the heat source for that room is not near an outside wall, but more on the inside wall where they could get to it, to the basement.
Yeah.
And so the outside walls of the room probably are a little bit cooler as well.
Is there any sort of insulation that I could put in between, in addition to the heated flooring? You know, if I do like one of those little electric wire flooring mats, could I have that on top of, say, some styrofoam boards?
That's not necessarily a good idea. That's one of those things where you'll have to follow the manufacturer's recommendations as to what you can or cannot put the heating pad over the top of.
Right.
Because anytime we're generating heat, styrofoam is not necessarily our best insulator.
Okay. Styrofoam can melt or burn. Is there any other insulating products I could use so that it's not just generating more heat or using more electricity, but maybe acting more as an insulator?
There are some products out there, some backer boards that have some insulating values. You'll probably have to go back to whoever you're getting your heating unit from and find out what they recommend you put it over the top of.
Okay.
So the manufacturer should have a recommendation. Hey, you know, if you're going to use our heated floor, you need to put it over the top of a substrate, and they will give you some recommendations as to what type of substrate that should be.
Okay.
All right.
All right. Thank you. We had a comment from a caller who said for the woman with the electrical problem, you might want to check the polarity of the wiring of the house. Is that?
That can be an issue as well. If an outlet is, particularly one is added, if somebody puts the black wire on the white screw instead of the gold screw, we can end up with a reverse polarity.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, that is something. I assume that since they said that they checked the outlet for grounding, that the tester they would test should have tested for polarity as well.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it's definitely something her electrician's going to have to start checking through and finding out why how we're getting a hot surface to anything that the cable would be connected to.
Okay. Well, let's go right on to Bourbonnais on line two. Line two, good morning.
Good morning to you. Thanks. Every winter, we get a buildup of ice in the gutters and the adjacent roof in the areas surrounding our entryway. So I'm thinking of putting in the electric wires that you just plug in, and they keep that area warm enough so that the ice doesn't build up. Do you like that idea? Is there something I should consider when I'm doing that?
There are several different types of heat tapes and ice melt systems that would work for something like that. What I like to do is back up one more step and say, okay, if I'm getting this ice buildup over my entryway, why? Where is that water coming from that is refreezing on the roof? You may want to look into making sure that you've got adequate ventilation for your attic and also good insulation over the main portion of the attic. What happens is we get a snow on the roof, and any heat in the attic then tries to melt that snow. The melted snow or the water runs down underneath the layer of snow along the shingles until it hits a portion of the roof that is no longer heated. In other words, they're not getting the heat loss from inside the house. And so it's colder, and it refreezes, and it causes this ice damming or these icicles to form out the outside edges. So if we go back to the main portion of the house and we insulate it so we have less melt of the snow, in other words, if we've got a good insulating barrier between the house and the attic, and then we've got good ventilation, the attic temperature should stay cool enough that we don't get rapid melting of the snow, so therefore we don't end up with a large accumulation of ice at the other end. So, I mean, you can take care of it by, you know, if it's something that there's just no way we can get insulation in or there's no way this can be ventilated, then yes, we can move to an electrical heat source of some sort, a heat tape or a wire that'll run through the gutter that'll help keep the gutter warm enough that we don't end up with the ice forming. But I always like to go back to the source rather than fixing the symptom, whereas the problem may be a little bit higher up. So it's something you may want to take a look into the attic as well.
Well, Last summer, we did do that. We put in shunts to increase the ventilation. And if I remember correctly, they did add some insulation.
Okay. So we may not have the ice problem this year as you've had in the past.
Well, we did. We did have it last winter.
Okay. Oh, you did it before last winter?
Yeah, it was done last summer.
Okay. Well, like I say, if you can't correct the problem from, you know, okay, why is my snow melting and why is it refreezing in that area, then yes, they do make some ice melt systems that you could install either on the shingles or in the gutters to help reduce the accumulation. I'm assuming what's happening is you're getting big icicles over the top of the doorway that can oftentimes be intimidating.
Well, that's part of it, but the ice actually fills the gutter and rises a little bit above it.
Okay, and the only way the ice is going to form is if there's water running to it. So apparently there is water melting or snow melting somewhere else that is running to that area, and obviously that area is not overheated spot, so therefore it is refreezing in that spot. And yes, and for that, for what you're describing, a heat tape or an ice melting system for the gutters, they do make several different brands, and they can run down. We put them inside the gutter itself and then run down the downspout to an outlet where you can plug it in.
Not on the ones I've seen. I've done a little bit of study, but not a lot. The one I've seen have a zigzag along the roof above the gutter.
Okay, that is not going to help your ice problem in the gutter. What that is going to do is that's going to melt the ice that's on the shingles or melt the snow on the shingles and cause more water into the gutter.
Okay.
And since the gutter is going to be the cold spot, it's still going to freeze in the gutter. So where if your problem is your gutter is filling with ice, what we need to do is run the heat system in the gutter and not try and melt more snow to run to the gutter.
Well, I like the sense of that.
Because melting more snow above the gutter just means that we have more water running into the gutter, and since the gutter isn't heated, that's where it's going to freeze.
Right.
So a heat tape or a wire running through the gutter, a system that you could plug in or a system that can turn on, it's be turned on at different temperature levels to melt the water or melt the ice in the gutter and get the gutter to continue to flow would be the answer to this problem, not adding more water by melting more snow on top of it.
Okay. That's good. Anything else I should know? Or?
Like I say, again, in order to get that much ice into the gutter, we've got to have a lot of snow melt. And if we've got that much snow melt, I'm curious as to what's causing the melting of the snow. Because if we've got good ventilation and good insulation, the roof really should not have that high of a melting rate. If you drive around the neighborhood and look at houses after a couple inches of snow and look at the ones that have little or no snow on them, those are the houses that need insulation. And the ones that have lots of snow 5 days after the snowfall are the ones that are well insulated and well ventilated. So it's one of those things. After the snow, go out there and look. You may find that you've got a spot in your roof that seems to melt faster than others, which would indicate a heat source or a lack of insulation in that area. And correcting that may be just as important as trying to get the water out of the gutter system.
So adding more insulation would be a remedy for that then? That would be getting at the source of it?
Generally speaking, yes. I mean, there's always different situations that, of course, I can't see over the radio. But usually what we want to do is we want to take the heat from the house and insulate it from the attic so we're not losing heat into the attic.
Right.
Then we ventilate the attic so any heat that does go through there, we ventilate to the outside. So the bottom of the roof sheathing stays fairly close to outdoor ambient temperatures. So therefore, if we've got snow on the roof, this snow stays on the roof and melts very slowly or evaporates due to sun exposure rather than a warm attic melting all the snow from the bottom side and letting it run down the shingles into the gutters.
Right.
Okay. I think we need to move along here because we still have several callers backed up and about 12 minutes to go in the program. But let's go on to line 3 from Champaign. Good morning, Champaign.
Yes, good morning. I had a question on an interior fireplace. It has a brick surround on it, and I'm getting some sort of white, chalky-looking on some of the bricks. It seems to be coming through. It's sort of, I guess you might say, it's sort of like efflorescence you might see on an outdoor chimney.
I was going to say, it is going to be efflorescent, so somewhere you've got some water coming in.
Although the house is pretty well insulated, so it's got six-inch walls with 1 inch of styrofoam, and It has, this is a drop-in chimney, I mean a drop-in fireplace, you know, prefabricated, and it just has a brick surround on the interior wall. And I'm just wondering what would be, since it, the house has got carpet and stuff, I'm kind of leery about getting here and brushing too much because I'll make a giant mess. Any suggestions on how we might clean this off? It's not everywhere, but it's got some bricks have it, some bricks don't.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on what would be the best way to clean it without making too big a mess?
Well, you're going to have to put some plastic down and tape the plastic down because, yeah, you're going to have to brush it, either wash or brush it off. Generally speaking, the efflorescence or the white film is the minerals and salts from the brick and from the mortar, and somehow some moisture has gotten to it and dissolved them and then come to the surface and dried and left these crystals behind.
It seems to be still coming out occasionally. It's not always, it's getting a little bit worse. It's just certain bricks. None of the mortar has it. It's just on the brick itself.
Yeah, you'll see it on the brick much more so than the mortar. And, you know, your best bet is to take a good stiff nylon brush and try and brush it off. I wouldn't want to use a steel brush on it because the steel gets stuck in there.
Do you use any chemicals when you do that or not? Just
At this point, no, I wouldn't. It would be nice to find out where the moisture source is coming from. It's one of those things you may want to get up in the attic and look and see if the chase, since your chimney flue is a round peg, flue, and the chase is built usually square. You know, you put a round peg through a square hole, there's always some air gaps around it. And we could be getting some cold air from the attic actually falling down inside that chase and keeping that brick cold, which means we'll get some condensation on that brick. So you might look and see if we've got an opening in the attic that's allowing cold attic air down inside around there. If it's on the outside of the house, if it built it around the outside,
well,
there's not much you can do.
The chimney is, kind of kneed out on the side of the house.
Okay, then there's...
But it was just cut in, and I have like 6-inch walls with 1 inch of styrofoam, you know, for the walls. And then the surround is built over the, around the fireplace and off to the sides of it a bit, you know, even beyond where the knee out is for the fireplace. So, but that's a thought, although I'll try. I didn't know what the best way to clean it off without getting stuff all over the carpet.
Actually, since it's dissolving with the water.
I haven't tried with water.
Water should be, you shouldn't need any chemicals with it, no.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
And thanks for your call. We've got 10 minutes left in the program and a caller on line 4 from Piatt County. Good morning.
Oh hello.
Hi.
I have a friend who has an old farmhouse, and they have an old fuel oil furnace. And she is agonizing over whether to get is it the thermal electric, the gas thermal, the new one?
Yeah, geothermal.
Yeah, thank you, geothermal. And I just thought, she hasn't done much research, but, I mean, is there any advantage, I mean, for an old farmhouse, I mean, that has... to put in a geothermal system?
Well, a geothermal system is an expensive system to install, so a lot of it has to depend on, okay, how long are we going to maintain the possession of the house? What are the overall plans with the house? You know, are we going to be fixing it up? An old farmhouse, of course, has lots of areas where we can do things to help weatherize the house, winterize it a little bit better to make sure that we don't have as much heat loss as it was not built with most of those things back in the day. So there's a lot of updating that can be done. So it kind of depends on which direction you're going to go. A geothermal is a relatively efficient system. Depends on what you can get as far as utilities to the property. How rural is it? Is there a way that a natural gas line can get to it?
It's easily accessible that way.
You'll probably find that while the geothermal system is nice, that if you've got access to a natural gas line, it's probably going to be less costly to install a natural gas type system. And if you were to do some numbers, while the geothermal is more efficient, it's going to take an awful long time to pay it back. And it's one of those things where, okay, if I'm going to spend this much money to put geothermal in and it's going to take me 25 years to pay it back and I'm only going to be in the house for 15, it's not a very good decision. So there's a lot more factors. I'm a big proponent of the geothermal for areas that do not have the natural gas abilities or for the people that are trying to really upgrade a house or build a new house because it's a very efficient system. It's a very good use of energy. It's a very, green So I do like the geothermal, but for each individual case, you do have to look at it and say, okay, if I put in geothermal, what is going to be my payback opposed to putting in a high-efficiency natural gas-type system?
Yes, and are there people around who are, I mean, since it seems so new, I mean, are there people around this area who do that, do you think?
Oh, yes. Well? There are definitely, and there's different types of systems, geothermal systems, whether we drill a hole and run a ground loop, or whether we've got a lake nearby that we can run a loop through a pond or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's several different styles and types, and it's one of those things where there's no generic blanket clause that says, oh, this is going to work, because it's going to change for different applications.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your overview.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And thank you. And I'll give the phone number one more time here, 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. We've got about 6.5 minutes left and one caller on the line from Champaign. Good morning, Champaign.
Is this me?
Yes.
Okay. You didn't indicate the line number. I have a walkout basement, a partial finished walkout basement. My house was built in the early 60s. It was a system called a strut wall construction, which I think at the time was promoted by Thompson Lumber Company. And on the walkout portion of this partial basement, there are two patio doors and two windows. It's about 20 feet long. It's a non-load-bearing wall because in the middle of that wall there is a steel post with a steel beam resting on top of it, which supports the joists for the upper floors. But this past summer, just a couple of months ago, when we went to replace the patio door, the old aluminum patio doors that were there, we took the aluminum framing out, and underneath that was a subsill, which it was a 2x4, but it had been planed at an angle. And when we took that 2x4 out, we discovered that it was not resting on a footing at all, but in fact had been placed there, and then the concrete that forms the floor had been run underneath it, had been poked underneath it from one side, and from the other side, concrete for a sort of a stoop, outside stoop, had been poked underneath there. That outside stoop slopes the wrong way. It slopes toward the house, but there's a very large, wide overhang of a roof above it so that it rarely gets water. I guess my question is, I guess one other fact that you need to know is that after we took those, cut out those two subsills for the patio door, we were faced with a trench there, which went down right, as far as we could tell, right down to the earth, although there seemed to be some little scraps of brick bats that had cinder block bats that had been stuck in there to hold that thing in place, to hold that wooden sill in place. We filled those areas with mortar, and then on top of that, we put a piece of correct deck, this sort of artificial plastic decking material, and then that was the subsill on which we rested the new patio doors. My question is, what's going to happen to this thing in the wintertime, and what should I do to prevent it? There's another associated question. The wall material is a asbestos from the old days, eighth-inch asbestos, and it's cracked around the bottom, and maybe that's from frost heaving. I'm not sure. And should I fill those areas? Those are well big enough for a rodent to get through. Should I fill those areas with that sort of expanding foam that you get?
Okay, well, it sounds like you definitely have an interesting situation there.
Yeah. And I just wonder if that kind of construction was common in the early 60s when they...
No, it really wasn't.
Okay.
That matter of fact, it's kind of got me thrown almost to the point where I need to have a recommendation of an architect or an engineer to try and make sure, because what you've described, I think you are probably going to end up with some frost heave, as you mentioned, and some movement. The main reason for setting exterior walls on a footing and foundation is so that we end up with some support 30 inches or 40 inches down into the ground, so we don't have any up and down movement as soil expands and contracts with temperature, humidity, and freezing. So I think without a proper footing underneath it, if that is indeed the case, that we are going to get some movement. So no matter what you do, you're going to end up with some problems until somebody goes and cuts that in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one that may be a little more detailed than what we can actually get into over the radio, and it may require to have an architect come out there and say, oh, this is what we're going to have to do. Now, when we do get into architects and engineers, they do tend to over-design things for their own protection. So a good contractor oftentimes will work for that case as well.
Okay.
As far as your asbestos goes, of course, anytime we have a cement asbestos product, there are certain safety precautions that need to be taken. Don't snort the powdered asbestos.
Right. This is hard asbestos. And your dad told me that that's another question I had. I've put on the rest of the house, I've put siding, cement board siding, over top of that asbestos on the recommendation of your dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the asbestos fiber is only dangerous if it's inhaled. So
exactly.
As long as it's encased in concrete, you have a very slim chance of actually inhaling it unless you
right.
go around and start sanding and scraping on it or
right.
grinding on it and coating it with a coat of paint to encapsulate or seal any loose fibers will, again, reduce any fibers moving around. Of course, holes through a wall where we can get rodents in, yes, there, you do want to fill those. The spray urethane foam, the expanding foams do work for that as long as they are protected from direct sunlight.
Okay.
UV rays will deteriorate the foam, so it is not a good material to use exterior unless you are putting a covering of some sort over the top of it.
Well, that area does receive sunlight, but I guess what I'll do is just let the foam ooze out and not cut it away, so that some of the foam protects the other foam from the sunlight, and the outside may deteriorate. I think what I want to do.
Okay, well, we're out of time here.
Yeah, so. We're going to have to wrap it up, I'm afraid, but. Well, anyway, thank you for your call, and I appreciate it. And sorry to cut people off,
yes.
But we really are running out of time here. So I do want to say, well, thanks to all the callers this morning, and, of course, thanks to you, Scott Spees. It's great to have you here.
Well, thank you, and as always, if they have additional questions, they can call us at the office.
Yeah, no, we really appreciate that and appreciate you taking the time every month to come in here and answer some home improvement questions. Well, that is about it for me. I'm your guest host, David Teal, for this hour of Focus. But there will be more of Focus coming up in just a few minutes here following news from National Public Radio.